Hello, folks. Welcome to Labor Relations Information Systems' First Thursday podcast for April 2017. My name is Will Aitchison. For the next 45 minutes or so, I'll be talking to you about some recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. And we have a couple of major court decisions that have come down in the last 30 days or so. One of them comes from the California Supreme Court and deals with the use of private cell phones by public employees and whether or not that use can create public records. There's also a case from the Florida Supreme Court about the circumstances under which an employer can unilaterally cancel a collective bargaining agreement. And those are, I think, both very important decisions that have some principles that I think extend across the country. But first, I want to start off with a little bit of a rant, if I can. Normally, I have a whole lot of respect for the guys and gals in the black robes. I totally understand it's not easy being a judge, and I read a lot of court opinions, and by and large, I think that courts get these issues right. And by get these issues right, I think what I really mean is I think my opinion is the same as theirs. Now, it could be my opinion is wrong and that we're all wrong. And certainly I have a couple of 14-year-olds at home who are not at all convinced that my opinion is like ever right. But for what it's worth, normally I do think courts come up with the right opinions. Not so the Illinois Court of Appeals in a case concerning the finality of binding arbitration. Before I get into this case, I want to talk just a little bit about what binding arbitration is and what it isn't. Binding arbitration is a feature of most collective bargaining agreements in the country. It's also a feature of many, many contracts in the country. If you have, for example, applied for a credit card lately, chances are you've agreed to arbitrate disputes with the bank that issues the credit card. If you have purchased a car, chances are you've agreed to binding arbitration. If you've even made just routine purchases online, you may well have agreed to binding arbitration. It's a feature of our lives in a lot of ways that sometimes we're not even onto. What exactly is binding arbitration? It is a system of private justice. It is where the parties to a contract say, in lieu of court resolution of any claims that we have about breach of contract, we're going to put those claims in the hands of a private judge, an arbitrator. We will prescribe a method of selecting the arbitrator. We may agree on some procedures that are going to be used in arbitration, and we're going to agree that the arbitrator's decision is final and binding. And that is our replacement for litigation through the court system as to whether or not a contract, in our case, a collective bargaining agreement, has been breached. Why would parties agree to binding arbitration? Several reasons. First of all, arbitrators have an awful lot of experience doing labor cases. That's not always the case with courts, and it's certainly not always the case with juries who likely are seeing their first labor relations issue in their lives. Court dockets are incredibly clogged around the country. Some parts of the country, it may take you 5 to 7 years to get a civil case to trial. Arbitration is much, much faster. And also, arbitration tends to be a much more economically efficient process. You don't tend to have lots of discovery. Normally, you don't take depositions. There's no interrogatories or requests for production, the sorts of things that precede court proceedings. So, arbitration is, I think, widely thought of, and I think correctly thought of, as a more expeditious process of resolving disputes under a collective bargaining agreement, and not just more expeditious, but less expensive and more likely to reach a correct result. But you pay a price when you agree to final and binding arbitration, and that price is that the arbitrator's decision is final and binding. And many times the United States Supreme Court and courts around the country have had to consider what final and binding means. And the usual rule of thumb out there is this: as long as an honest arbitrator, meaning there can't be any evidence of collusion or corruption, as long as an honest arbitrator is deciding an issue that is within the broad confines of the contract, the arbitrator's decision should be upheld. And the fact that a court is convinced that an arbitrator was wrong on the facts and wrong on the law is not sufficient to overturn the arbitrator's opinion. And the reason for that is, if you're going to allow free challenges to arbitrators' opinion, if you, the courts, are going to allow that, what have you accomplished? You haven't accomplished anything. All of the advantages of binding arbitration are gone. Plus, you're looking at two parties who once upon a time agreed that arbitration would be final and binding. That agreement has to mean something. So it's extraordinarily rare to see an arbitrator's opinion overturned. So what's this case that has my dander up? As I mentioned, comes out of Illinois, comes out of the Cook County Forest Preserve District. And this district has a law enforcement agency, and the rank and file officers there are represented by the Fraternal Order of Police. The FOP filed a couple of grievances, and it concerned the placement of newly promoted patrol officers on the sergeant's salary schedule. So where do they go on the salary schedule once they're promoted? The FOP's position was, you look at their length of service with the employer, and then you look at the salary schedule and how many years of service do you need for this step or that step, and you put them on the salary schedule according to whatever their length of service is. What's the employer's position? Newly promoted sergeants get the equivalent of a two-step increase on the patrol officer's salary schedule without regard to their length of service. So what does that mean? It means, for example, if you have a 15-year officer who's promoted, that officer's likely, under the FOP's argument, to be put at the top of the salary schedule. Under the employer's argument, that officer would only get a 2-pay step increase instead of perhaps a 5 or 6 or 7 pay step increase. So that's what the dispute is. Goes to an arbitrator. The arbitrator says, well, first of all, there's nothing in the contract that specifically answers my question as to which of these two arguments is valid. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn to the past practice. And there is a historic past practice between these parties that is the way the FOP is arguing things should be done. You should be put on the salary schedule based on your total longevity with the district. And the arbitrator rules in the FOP's favor. For reasons you never really can tell, the district challenges the arbitrator's opinion in court. And say, when I say for reasons you can't really tell, this is an odd one for the employer to challenge. Because, you know, when you're promoting people, you probably want to bend over backwards to treat them fairly, because these are your managers, your future managers and your agency. It's one thing to say, hey, look, this is where, you know, we put you on the salary schedule and to face a grievance and go to arbitration over the grievance. It's yet another thing for the employer to say, we feel so strongly about paying you less money that we're going to challenge the arbitrator's opinion in court. So that's why I kind of view this as odd, and I think it's actually been years since I've seen a challenge to an arbitrator's decision in a promotional case, probably for that reason. But the exception makes the rule, and the district challenged the arbitrator's opinion. And the case goes to the Illinois Court of Appeals. The court starts off on the right track. The court says, the review of arbitrators' decisions in court is extremely limited, and we have to uphold the opinion if the award draws its essence from the collective bargaining agreement. The court even goes so far as to say the arbitrator, not the court, determines the meaning of the collective bargaining agreement. And then, those preliminaries out of the way, the court goes badly astray, at least in my judgment. Here's what the court says. I'm just going to read you a couple of sentences here, maybe three sentences, and think about what I'm reading in the context of who makes the decision as to what the facts are and what the law is. The court says, the arbitrator, and I'm quoting, imposed his own personal view of right and wrong on the labor dispute. The arbitrator's rationale for deviating from the employer's personnel rules was the long-standing past practice of paying newly promoted sergeants based on their years of service. But the arbitrator provides no example of this practice, nor does the union, and even if the union could provide evidence of the practice, a long-standing policy outside the contract does not draw its essence from the contract. And the arbitrator overturns the court overturns the arbitrator's opinion. What's wrong with that? Well, just about everything. First of all, the arbitrator finds the facts as to whether or not there is a past practice. That's a factual finding. And the court has no business second-guessing the arbitrator's conclusion as to whether or not certain facts exist or not. Remember, arbitrators have the right to be wrong on the facts and have their opinions upheld. So that's the first place the court goes astray. And then there's that whopper of a last sentence, a long-standing policy outside the contract doesn't draw its essence from the contract. Excuse me, but nonsense. That's what a past practice is. And I can give you a couple tens of thousands of arbitration opinions that are based on past practice, and I can give you thousands of court opinions that uphold arbitrators' decisions based on past practice. And that's a conclusion of law as to whether or not there's a past practice that puts some sort of interpretation, some sort of glint of light on the collective bargaining agreement. And arbitrators make those conclusions of law. So here you have a court saying the arbitrator was wrong on the facts, therefore the arbitrator's opinion should be overturned. But even if he was right on the facts, he was wrong on the law, and therefore there's another reason to overturn the arbitrator's opinion. All of that, I think, is wrong. The collective bargaining agreement here had a wage schedule. The placement of employees on a wage schedule can, in fact, be determined by what past practice is or past practice isn't. Well, I'm going to conclude. As I said, this is a little bit of a rant. I'm going to conclude with some words from a Supreme Court justice who was talking about the fact that the decisions of the United States Supreme Court are final. At least they're final with respect to the interpretation of the Constitution. And he was asked, this justice was asked, why is it that in our system of jurisprudence, in our constitutional system, we accord finality to the decisions of the Supreme Court? And his answer, which couldn't be more witty or more fun in my judgment, was, we are not final because we are right. We are right because we are final. That same phrase could be said about arbitrators' opinion. Won't be said about this decision, I would predict, of the Illinois Court of Appeals. That decision in and of itself may be appealed, but certainly the principles that it stands for, I don't think will be allowed to stand in Illinois, not for very long. Let's move on now to California and that big decision, one that a lot of people have been waiting for from the California Supreme Court on when private cell phone records also are public records potentially subject to disclosure under a Freedom of Information Act or Public Records Act. This is a case that comes out of San Jose. It began many years ago. It began in 2009 when a fellow named Ted Smith asked for 32 categories of public records from the city. Ted Smith was focusing on the city's redevelopment agency and in particular on the agency's executive director. He also targeted some other elected officials and their staff. And what he wanted were records concerning redevelopment efforts in downtown San Jose. He asked for everything. He wanted emails and text messages that were, and I'm quoting, sent or received on private electronic devices used by the mayor, two city council members, and their staffs. The city made a whopper of a disclosure to Smith, disclosing communications and records of all sorts, including communications made using city telephone numbers and email accounts. But the city drew the line at communications made using the individual's personal accounts. Smith protested, and that's the case that made its way to the California Supreme Court. Now, California has a Public Records Act that's really, I think, very similar to that that exists in almost every other state, in fact, every other state that I know of. The Public Records Act establishes sort of a basic rule in favor of disclosure of public records. In fact, as the California Supreme Court talks about in the San Jose case, the public records law creates a presumption of access to any record that is maintained by a public agency. Now, there's some curious language in the California's Public Records Act. It refers to things that are, and I'm quoting, writings being disclosed. And so the first question that the California Supreme Court has to answer in Smith's case is, are cell phone records writings as far as the Public Records Act was concerned? And the court actually struggles with that a little bit. The court goes back to when the act was passed, which was in 1968. There's that five-year period from about 68 to 73 where many Public Records Acts were passed around the country. And the court says, you know, back in 1968, creating a writing could be a pretty involved process. You would actually use an implement to type or record words longhand, or you would dictate to someone else who would write or type a document. So writings were on paper, and these writings were, it was easy to identify what they were and how to retrieve them and look at the repositories where they were stored. That was easy back in 1968. But today, when you have electronic communications, it's a little bit tougher to tell exactly what a writing is. The court says not only are they stored in various electronic platforms, they're stored much more easily and much more quickly. And the court also says, and you can see the court actually probably talking about its own cell phone use, the ease and immediacy of electronic communication has encouraged a commonplace tendency to share fleeting thoughts and random bits of information with varying degrees of import, often to broad audiences. What a lovely sentence, really. And I felt when I read it the first time that it was talking about my Facebook posts, but I think they're talking about everybody's Facebook posts and tweets and, you know, comments on blogs, whatever it might be. So the court says, now that we've got the job of figuring out what a writing is in this new electronic age, how do we answer that question? And the court says maybe the best way to answer that question is to look at the subject of the communication. If something is, broadly speaking, a writing, including something that was created electronically, it will be a public record if it, and now I'm going to quote again because this is really important, relates in some substantive way to the conduct of the public's business. The court says, look, this is a broad standard. We get that. But it's not so broad that it includes every piece of information that the public may find interesting. Now, here comes another quote that's very important. Communications that are primarily personal, containing no more than incidental mentions of agency business, generally will not constitute public records. For example, the public might be titillated to learn that not all agency workers enjoy the company of their colleagues or hold them in high regard. However, an employee's electronic musings about a colleague's personal shortcomings will often fall short of being a writing containing information relating to the conduct of the public's business. So, what we have through this part of the court's opinion is that cell phone records, text messages, whatever, records of cell phone calls, those are writings. They're potentially subject to disclosure under a public records law, even if they're made on private communications devices. But not everything. It's going to have to relate to the conduct of the public's business. Well, now the court comes to the $64,000 question. Who decides whether or not this type of material, cell phone records, text messages, relates to the public's business? And how do you balance an employee's privacy rights in their own personal cell phone records versus the public's right to know? And the court gives a fascinating answer to this. The court says, we think that searches for responsive documents, documents responsive to a public records request, we think they can, under some circumstances, constitute an unwarranted invasion of privacy. However, searches can be conducted in a manner that respects individual privacy. Well, what, pray tell, is that manner? If I'm a public employee, I'm a police officer or firefighter for San Jose, and I've got my personal cell phone, and the employer gets a Public Records Act request for my text messages, the mere fact that I have to turn the phone over to the employer and have the employer go through my text messages, I'm going to consider that to be a breach of my privacy rights. Well, says the California Supreme Court, fear not. You don't have to turn your phone over. Why not? Here's the end of the court's opinion. The Public Records Act does not prescribe specific methods of searching for documents. Agencies may develop their own internal policies for conducting searches. As to requests seeking public records held in employees' non-governmental accounts, an agency's first step should be to communicate the request to the employees in question. The agency may then reasonably rely on these employees to search their own personal files, accounts, and devices for responsive material. Well, if I'm Ted Smith, I'm not a pretty happy man when I've read that last sentence, right? Because who gets to decide whether or not records on private cell phones get to be turned or have to be turned over in response to a Public Records Act request? The employee who owns the cell phone. That, says the court, is the first step in the process. And where it sounds like I may be a little bit skeptical about this opinion, actually, I really like this opinion a lot. I think the court was really on the horns of a dilemma here, because we have a decision, very important one, Riley versus State of California from about 3 years ago, from the U.S. Supreme Court saying that cell phones are in fact a repository of an incredible amount of private information protected by the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unlawful searches and seizures. And the court in Riley specifically says if the government wants to get into a private cell phone, It's got to have probable cause, and it has to have a warrant. And a lot of us who do employment law have been struggling with how Riley applies in an employment setting, but I think the general thought among most of us is Riley does apply. And when the employer is the government, it's got to have a basis for getting into the employee's cell phone record, and that's probably going to be reasonable suspicion that the employee has either violated a law or committed some sort of serious breach of the employer's rules. The employer can't simply demand that employees produce cell phones. So I think the California Supreme Court, recognizing this body of case law about cell phones in the background, even though it doesn't cite that body of case law, but I think it had to know that it existed, recognizes that employers here are really on the horns of a dilemma. Because on one hand, they may have obligations to disclose private cell phone records under a public records law, but on the other hand, to do so might be violating the constitutional rights of employees. So the court's answer is, you know, we're going to assume that employees are acting in good faith, and that when there is a request for their cell phone records, that they will honestly turn over the records that comply with those requests. And there's not going to be a need for employers to go through the private cell phones and other communication devices of employees. I think, on whole, that's a balanced decision. But I don't think that's a decision that's going to please Ted Smith at all. Before I get to that Florida case on an employer unilaterally imposing changes in a contract, I wanted to tell you about a case that we talk about in greater depth in our monthly newsletter, Public Safety Labor News. It's a random drug testing case. I just haven't seen one of these in a while. Random drug testing, you know, was all the rage for a while. Some employers went away from it. There's some pretty good evidence that random drug testing is a less effective and certainly more costly method of controlling drug use in the workplace than simply training supervisors to recognize the signs of drug abuse. And so sort of the national drive towards random drug testing for firefighters and police officers seemed to have stalled a while back. But now I see it coming back just a little bit and coming back in spots in some places here and there. And of course, we have yet to shake out what the law is going to be with respect to drug testing in those states where you have the legalization of marijuana, either the complete legalization like Washington or Oregon or Colorado, now California, or medical marijuana. We have yet to shake that out. But at any rate, there are some drug testing cases popping up, and there's one out of the Federal 10th Circuit Court of Appeals that we talk about at pretty great length in the newsletter that I just wanted to highlight a little bit about in this podcast. The question in the case is whether or not you can have random drug testing of corrections employees. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has never ruled on random drug testing of employees at all, but it came close once in a couple of cases, the most important one of which was known as the Von Raab case. In that case, the court held that the suspicionless, meaning there was no reasonable suspicion, suspicionless testing of customs officers who were seeking promotions did not violate the Constitution. And that's pretty close to random drug testing, and certainly lower federal courts for years and years in the wake of Von Raab have held that random drug testing of police officers and almost every court has said the same thing about firefighters, doesn't violate the federal Constitution. Now, there are some states that have said, you know, without regard to what the federal Constitution says, our state constitutions have greater rights to privacy than the federal Constitution, and even if you can have random drug testing under the federal Constitution, you can't under our state constitution. And those states include Alaska and Massachusetts and Arizona, and a couple of others, but those are the three most important states. But the general rule has been that the drug testing of public safety employees, random drug testing of public safety employees, doesn't violate the federal constitution. What we have not had a lot of are random drug testing cases involving corrections officers. And that's what this Tenth Circuit case ends up having to decide. Tenth Circuit, by the way, is kind of the middle Midwest part of the country, extending over to Denver and Colorado. And the court in this case is dealing with a Kansas juvenile detention center that had a random drug testing program. A lieutenant by the name of Roderick Washington test positive for cocaine in the random testing program, and he files a lawsuit saying the federal constitution prohibits random drug testing of corrections officers. The question is, are corrections officers different than police officers and firefighters for purposes of random drug testing? Do they have more in the way of privacy rights? And the Tenth Circuit unanimously says no, they're treated the same. There's nothing in the federal constitution that prohibits random drug testing of corrections officers. And the court goes on really at some length in talking about why that is the case. But the court ends up really focusing on what it refers to as the unique situation of working with juveniles in an educational setting. The court ends up saying that when an employee is in a custodial, really in what the law calls an in loco parentis relationship with a minor, especially at-risk minors of the sort you would expect to be in a juvenile detention facility, that employee's illegal drug use presents a risk of harm to the minor that the employer has a right to control through random drug testing. So I don't think this is a big surprise with respect to the law. It's just, I highlight it only because we just haven't seen that many corrections drug testing cases. And I think it's not at all surprising to find a federal court of appeals saying corrections officers really not substantively different in the law in this area than our firefighters and police. Okay, now over to Florida, and let's talk about this City of Miami case involving whether an employer can unilaterally change a contract. And to know this, to understand this case, I have to give you a little bit of context, because there are two separate statutory schemes in Florida that really are at issue here. One is the collective bargaining statute, public employee collective bargaining statute, and the other is a financial emergency statute that exists in the state. The collective bargaining statute is a pretty standard, to a point, meet and confer type collective bargaining statute. So in other words, it obliges the parties to meet and confer to negotiate about topics that are mandatory subjects of bargaining. But it varies a little bit from most meet and confer statutes in the way it winds up. To be sure, it winds up with the employer being allowed to unilaterally impose its last best offer. And that's the way meet and confer statutes end up, as opposed to binding arbitration. But Florida has an additional step. And the additional step is, if you can't get an agreement through good faith bargaining, and you've gone through the mediation process, you have what's known as a special magistrate who comes in. And this special magistrate makes recommendations to both sides as to how the contract disputes should be resolved. So if you're, for example, you've got a wages issue that's open on the table and the employer is at 2% and the union is at 5%, the special magistrate can say, should be 2%, should be 3%, whatever the magistrate ends up recommending. The magistrate's decision is just that, a recommendation. And either side can reject it. And if it is rejected, the employer can go ahead and unilaterally impose its last best offer. So a basic meet and confer system with a little bit of a fillip there at the end. Now the other statute is what's known as a financial urgency statute. And this is a statute that says that if an employer, a city or a county in Florida, is facing a bona fide financial urgency, it can actually get in there and change wages and benefits in a collective bargaining agreement. And the question that the Florida Supreme Court has to address is, how do these two statutes fit together? If there is a financial urgency, does the employer still need to go through all of the steps of the bargaining process, including that special magistrate, or can it just go ahead and implement whatever changes it wants to its collective bargaining agreement? So how does this case come up? As I mentioned, this is a Miami case. It involves the police union there, which is Lodge 20 of the Fraternal Order of Police. And the lodge and the city are parties to a contract that runs from October 1, 2007 to September 30, 2010. So this is a pretty old case now. And about 2 months before the contract expires, in fact, 2 months and a couple of days, the city declares a financial urgency and notifies Lodge 20 that it intends to implement all sorts of changes. There's a little bit of bargaining that goes on between both sides, and very quickly the city notifies Florida's labor relations entity, which is the Public Employees Relations Commission, that they're at loggerheads and there's a dispute between them. And very quickly, the city votes to unilaterally alter the terms of the collective bargaining agreement to address the financial urgency. So here's the timing on it. July 28th, as I mentioned, city declares financial urgency. Somewhere in August, there's some little bit of bargaining. Somewhere in August, the city notifies PERC that bargaining hasn't resolved all their issues. And by the end of August, only about 34 days after it declares the financial urgency, the city votes to change the contract. And what changes does it implement? Well, quite a few. The city imposes a tiered reduction of wages, elimination of education pay supplements, a freeze in step increases, a freeze in longevity pay, modification of the normal retirement date, modification of the pension benefit formula, a cap on the average final compensation for pension benefit calculations, alteration of the usual retirement formula, and modification of what average final compensation is for purposes of the pension. I almost wanted to end that with a partridge in a pear tree. That's quite a list of changes that the city implements. Well, Lodge 20 decides it's not going to take that lying down, so it files an unfair labor practice charge with the Public Employment Relations Commission, and that's the case that ends up before the Florida Supreme Court. Now, to be sure, the evidence is that the city was really in terrible financial condition. The city's annual budget was $500 million, and it faced a deficit of $140 million. Get that, almost a 30% budget deficit. The city had already implemented hiring freezes, had done layoffs, had ceased procurement, had instituted elimination of jobs as employees left, etc., etc. About the only thing that the city didn't do was to increase taxes, but the city pointed to the fact, look, why are we going to be thinking about increasing taxes when the unemployment rate is 13.5% and 49% of the homes in the city have negative equity? So there's no doubt the city is in terrible financial condition. So how does the Florida Supreme Court reconcile these two statutes, the collective bargaining statute on one hand, and on the other hand, the financial urgency statute. And the Supreme Court ends up agreeing with Lodge 20 and says that under the structure of our financial urgency laws and our collective bargaining laws, in almost all cases, and certainly here, the city has to go through the bargaining process first before it implements changes in the collective bargaining agreement. The court says, look, there's financial emergencies and there's financial emergencies. The court gives a pretty specific definition. The court says that a financial urgency justifying modification of a contract is, and I'm quoting, a dire financial condition requiring immediate attention and demanding prompt and decisive action, but not necessarily a financial emergency or bankruptcy. The mere fact that it is politically expedient to take one road versus another isn't a compelling reason to modify a collective bargaining agreement. So, in other words, the court says here, look, you could have gone through the special magistrate process. That could have actually happened pretty quickly. And you haven't shown us why we went from 0 to 60 in about 34 days. That doesn't sound like the stuff of which a financial urgency is made, at least a financial urgency that allows one party to a contract to simply tear it up and impose its own terms and agreement. The court says, look, when you're in this sort of bargaining environment, the employer needs to prove and prove to a way that survives our strict scrutiny that the action that you are taking really addresses a financial urgency and that there's really no alternatives. And you haven't shown that here, Miami. You haven't shown us that you faced enough of a crisis that quickly, that immediately, that you should be able to avoid the normal bargaining and special magistrate process. And the court ends up finding that an unfair labor practice was committed. Now, not a lot of states have these financial urgency statutes. There's a few, though. And I actually think this is probably the way these cases are going to come out. Even if you have a statute that allows an employer under some terrible financial conditions to take unilateral action, it's going to be a rare, rare case where that is going to be allowed, and almost a case that will never occur if the employer wants to do that quickly. Employers are going to be held to be able to foresee economic problems over a span of more than 34 days. I want to close with a sexual harassment case that comes to us courtesy of the Ninth Circuit out on the western part of the country. I think this is a bit of an important case. It is not talked about very often, but in this day and age, most sexual harassment cases are resolved in favor of the employer. I'm totally eyeballing this. But I would guess that well more than 95% of reported court opinions come out in the employer's favor. This is courtesy of a line of Supreme Court cases. I'm not going to get into them now. There's about five of them that were decided largely about 10, 12 years ago that effectively insulate employers from liability for most types of sexual harassment. And so it's very common today to see sexual harassment in the form of a hostile work environment, sexual harassment that you would look at and you just kind of cringe at the notion of what went on in the workplace, and a court to find that it didn't rise to the level of being actionable under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And so it's kind of odd to run into a case, particularly from a federal court of appeals, where the court actually allows a sexual harassment case to proceed. And so I did want to spend just a minute talking about this one. I think of it as the case of the hugging sheriff. And the hugging sheriff is a guy named Edward Prieto. And Edward Prieto was, or perhaps is, still, the sheriff of Yolo County, California. The other key player in this lawsuit is Victoria Zetwick, and she's a corrections sergeant. She's a corrections sergeant in 1999 when the sheriff is elected. And right after his election, he introduces himself to the corrections staff, and he shakes the hands of all the men, and he hugs all the women, including Zetwick. And in her lawsuit later on, Zetwick contends that from 1999 to 2012, so over a 13-year period of time, he subjected her to, he meaning the sheriff, subjected her to numerous unwelcome hugs, and at least one unwelcome kiss. He estimated that Prieto hugged her at least two dozen times in a three-year period of time, and that in the preceding following eight-year period of time, he hugged her at least 100 times. She made other allegations that this hugging occurred at parties in the sheriff's office, at awards banquets, when prisoners were getting their GEDs and the graduation ceremonies were held, at training sessions or at meetings. She did say, he never hugged me when we were alone, but she complained about all of this stuff repeatedly, she said. And she became the subject of teasing in the workplace. She said that her co-workers and supervising lieutenants teased her that Prieto was going to kiss her and that he was the target of all of her hugs. And eventually, Zetwick says, this got so bad that I started having an impact from it. I found it difficult to concentrate. I was constantly stressed and anxious about his touching, which I thought had sexual overtones. I started crying at work and in the locker room because of the stress from Prieto's conduct, that she lost sleep, she had to start taking sleep aids, that there was an impact on her marriage. And, you know, if all of the stuff that she says is true, and we have to assume it is for this stage of the litigation, I mean, you have to, you know, understand why she would react that way, right? I mean, I've never had a boss who particularly wanted to hug me, but if I did and the hugging was unwelcome, and for that to happen hundreds of times over the course of my employment, I mean, I'd be closing the door to my office and maybe barring it with a chair and hoping that the boss doesn't ever see me. I mean, you have to kind of understand it. Well, a federal trial court dismisses the lawsuit, says Zetwick doesn't allege that this is pervasive enough sexual harassment to meet the new and wonderful world of sexual harassment jurisprudence. And that's the case that goes to the Ninth Circuit. Is there, assuming everything that Zetwick says is true, do we have a potential basis for a lawsuit? And the court says yes. The court says, look, while it appears that Prieto's hugs were commonplace in the workplace, and while he hugged other women, neither of those things demonstrates, beyond dispute, that Prieto's hugging was within the scope of ordinary workplace socializing. A reasonable juror could find, the court said, that from the frequency of the hugs, that Prieto's conduct was out of proportion to ordinary workplace socializing and had become abusive. The court also said, look, the trial court failed to consider whether a reasonable juror could find that the hugs, the number, the frequency, the persistence of them, created a hostile work environment. We have held, we the Ninth Circuit, have held that where hugging includes, and I'm quoting, chest-to-breast contact, a reasonable juror and a reasonable woman, as if there's a difference between the two, could find the hugging created a hostile environment. Zetwick is correct that a hostile work environment is ambient and persistent, and that it continues to exist between overt manifestations. In other words, it's not just the hugging. It's all of the downtime between the hugs where the victim of the harassment lives in fear that the harassment is going to continue. And the court says this pattern of behavior, of unwanted contact, unwanted physical contact between a supervisor and a subordinate, this pattern of behavior is actionable under Title VII. Now, even as I'm saying everything that I just said, I realize how far we've come on sexual harassment law, that the court's finding here actually is a little bit surprising because of how unfriendly sexual harassment court decisions are these days to those who are bringing lawsuits. I mean, should I really have to talk about the fact that unwanted male-to-female hugging on hundreds of occasions could possibly constitute sexual harassment? It's actually a question you can't even believe that you really have to ask, isn't it? Anyway, the case is going back for trial, and if there's any developments that get reported in it, I'll bring you up to speed on it. Okay, that's it for our podcast. Hope to see you at our next seminar, which will be June in Las Vegas, on the rights of law enforcement officers. And as always, check in with us at LRIS.com or our Facebook page, LRIS Online, where we post with some regularity. So with that, this is Will Aitchison. Have a good month.